thought we'd give a couple of sessions this week, today and tomorrow, to Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and do that by way of a kind of low-key biography of Bonhoeffer, in which I will do sort of go through the different involvements of Bonhoeffer's life and pick up his writings along the way. So do a kind of biography and some reading of some passages and some interpretation. That should be a format which is very conducive to discussion. So it'll be conversational. Before doing that biography of Bonhoeffer's life and that biography, so to speak, of Bonhoeffer's thought, I wanted to finish up something that we started yesterday, but try to do it in a way that does not assume that assume that you were here yesterday. We talked yesterday about the meaning of world come of age and religion in Bonhoeffer, and I said at the conclusion that I thought Bonhoeffer had some very suggestive things to say about a kind of Christian style of living in a world come of age. And what I want to do today, before taking up the biography, is just to follow through on those suggestions. In the Letters and Papers from Prison, Bonhoeffer's last book, which was, as you know, wasn't written as a book, he says, and he's talking about the future as far as he can see now, he says, our being Christians today will be limited to two things, prayer and doing justice among men. All Christian thinking, speaking, and organizing must be born anew out of this prayer and this action. I think it's safe to say that Bonhoeffer's own life, from the church struggle which took place in the 30s, through his involvement in the political conspiracy against Hitler, which is in the 40s, his own life reflected a dialectic around these two poles, prayer, if that's a sort of shorthand for a life of worship, meditation, and doing justice among men, which is sort of shorthand for an engagement with people of all sorts and persuasions on in secular causes. So let's talk a little bit about these two poles of the dialectic, prayer and doing justice among men, because it's out of that I think that there are some suggestions about a Christian style of living. The first pole is named by Bonhoeffer in the Letters and Papers from Prison. He asks in one of the letters, in a world come of age, what is the significance of the arcane discipline, or the hidden discipline, or the secret discipline? Do some of you know where that comes from? The early church, New Testament church, took up the secret discipline, which was just a shorthand way of saying that the church met in houses, intense community, discipline, prayer, meditation, education, all in secret, all hidden from the world, in part because of the political circumstances. It was heresy. It was a violation of the political religious orthodoxy of Caesar. So the hidden, Bonhoeffer asks, is it not the time to take for the church to, he puts it another way, return to the conventicles, return to the small group, intense community, that sort of picture of the church, return to the arcane discipline. The goal of back to the conventicles, back to the, in the Pietist movement, 17th, 18th centuries, the phrase was ecclesioli in ecclesia, small churches within the larger church, church renewal groups within the denomination. That's part of what Bonhoeffer means by back to the conventicles. The goal there, and these are his words again, is innermost concentration for outward directed service. Innermost concentration for outward directed service. So, what I'm saying is that Bonhoeffer is thinking now, what should be the character of the church in a religionless situation, in a world come of age? And he thinks of the church as a kind of order, a kind of order. I've used that in the sort of Catholic sense of a life of rigorous discipline, commitments, but an order for outward directed service, some mission in mind that has to do with engaging the world. But the world, however, is the monastery. So the church is kind of an order. But the world is the monastery. In this order, arcane discipline is this innermost concentration. Bonhoeffer's fascination with Gandhi throughout his life stemmed in part from Gandhi's use of the ashram. The ashram being a time of building discipleship, of training small groups of cadres for the cause. And that training included not simply techniques of nonviolence, but a whole philosophy of life. And Bonhoeffer sees the arcane discipline, the hidden discipline that should characterize the church. Part of that stems from his fascination with Gandhi. In fact, Bonhoeffer sought, when he was a pastor in England, an invitation to go study with Gandhi. And this was before Bonhoeffer took up the directorship of the underground seminary. And he wanted to go learn from Gandhi, among other things, this training in intense community, the ashram. He, in fact, had to make a choice. He got the invitation to go to study with Gandhi. And then the Confessing Church, which was part of the church that broke from Hitler and had to become illegal, go underground, asked him to take the directorship, and Bonhoeffer simply had to choose one or the other. And he took heading up the underground seminary, in which then he tried, and the book that is a record of this is the book Life Together, in which he tried to carry out this picture of the church as characterized by the hidden discipline, the disciplines of meditation, building of an intense discipleship community. Bonhoeffer spent some time when he was a pastor in England traveling around to the Anglican orders that were trying to do something like that. All right, arcane discipline is as characterizing the church in a world come of age means the church is not for everybody. It's for very few. Bonhoeffer sees the church as the future of the future as being very small in numbers. At least he expects that this will be so, because he sees the sort of membership requirements as being very rigorous. it's a community of intense loyalty to Christ that is shared in worship, but that worship is not to and for all. That worship is for the members of the community. I just to draw a contrast, he's not talking about Hollywood Bowl and drive-in Easter services. He's not talking about TV and radio church programs. He's not talking about bumper sticker Christianity. I mean, he's not talking about public wearing of the faith. He's not talking about Sunday morning East Room White House services. And he's not talking about those prayers at the inauguration. If he wants to break with anything, he wants to break with a kind of acculturated religion, which in the cost of discipleship he calls religion of cheap grace. It's available to everybody. And where the church, as he says, baptized, confirmed, married, and buried a whole nation. He doesn't want that mix. He doesn't want a civil religion. So, and he He doesn't even want what he calls that religious handout at Riverside Church. He doesn't want the church that has an easy kind of Christianity, and so he doesn't think that the membership will be large, and he wants the membership to be characterized by this intense, demanding kind of discipleship, rigorous membership qualification. I wondered that myself, and I don't. It was the time of Harry Emerson Fosdick, but I don't know if in fact he was preaching that morning. It would be interesting.
Fosdick has many sides.
Yeah. I suspect, though, Bonhoeffer came out of a heavy Barthian influence at that time, and I doubt that anything. Yeah. Well, Harry Emerson Fosdick was a famous preacher at Riverside Church. Yeah. Yesterday, I just quoted a paragraph from Bonhoeffer's diary in which he talked about going to service at Riverside Church, which is a large church in Upper West Side Manhattan.
Incidentally, it was financed and built by the Rockefeller.
Yeah.
But that's not
the good stuff. Yeah, yeah. And Bonhoeffer said, in effect, that was so much garbage. And people could get along much better without that, without religion of that sort.
They used to have a song in the choir there, Praise John from
Homewood. John Rockefeller was funding the thing. All right. Okay, now this means that the church will include in its life a concentrated nurturing of the Jewish Christian tradition. Bonhoeffer, and again, this is in contrast to a lot of the people that have been inspired by Bonhoeffer in the so-called secular theologies. They didn't care, like Bonhoeffer cared for all of those gesimas of the church year, Septuagesima, Quintuagesima, all those saints and hoary traditions. Bonhoeffer lived from those things and said that's absolutely vital. And so in that sense, one time he came upon, during the time that he was in the resistance, he was writing the book Ethics in between resistance assignments, and he stayed in a monastery at Ettal in Germany, and he used to participate in the monks' daily office in their worship, and one time he was especially pleased because he came in, and on Christmas Eve, the monks were sitting around reading one another passages from The Cost of Discipleship, which was only one of the two books that was published in Bonhoeffer's lifetime. I say this because there's a side of Bonhoeffer that is intensely desirable for the tradition that we've associated with Roman Catholic orders, the monastic orders, or at least that regular daily meditation, that discipline of reflection, of study, of worship. And now Bonhoeffer wants the church of the future to be that kind of small membership intense community. Okay, so the church then is made up for the future of small groups of strongly committed Christians who constitute the church as a kind of low-profile Christian order in the world come of age. That's one pole. And he makes some radical proposals for the Church of Germany. Bonhoeffer had the job, if he had lived, of being the one who had to figure out church-state relations. For the post Hitler regime. And so he has to ask himself, what shape should the church in Germany in the future take? And believe me, these are radical kinds of proposals. So he says in Letters and Papers from Prison, the church should first of all sell everything that it has and go back to the conventicle, sort of house church type movement. And pastors should all live on voluntary salary. Now we have that, but in Germany they live from church taxes. They still do today. Okay, so Bonhoeffer is in fact reviving what is in Protestantism more or less the sectarian heritage. On the left wing of the Reformation, there were all sorts of small groups that broke off. Today they're the Mennonites. didn't become part of their official established churches, but remained separate, smaller, usually congregational in polity. Bonhoeffer is, in fact, kind of reviving the sectarian heritage of intense community. Okay, that's one pole in this, what he sees as a style of Christian life for the future. The other pole is the Christians, which we name it. If we name the first one arcane discipline, hidden discipline, I would say the other one we could call something like non-religious interpretation. Well, that's in ethics, that's a little bit esoteric. What I'm getting at is that he sees these small groups of Christians operating in the world rather incognito, making common cause with non-Christians without asking the non-Christians making any qualifications in participating with non-Christians in causes of social justice. Christians and non-Christians don't have to believe the same. You don't ask them to make any theological or ecclesiastical or any other kind of qualifications. You join in making common cause for the common good. In Bonhoeffer's own life, that comes out in his joining with agnostic, atheists, communists in the resistance movement. And that experience of making common cause for the common good with people of all different religious and ideological persuasions remains with Bonhoeffer. So Bonhoeffer says the Christian has to, on the one hand, have a very strong sense of identity as Christian. That's arcane discipline. On the other hand, full identification with the sufferings of the world. Identity and identification. And you have to play, the Christian plays out his life between those two. Now, there are theological reasons for that. Bonhoeffer says, where God is suffering is in the sufferings of the world. So Bonhoeffer thinks by a full immersion in life as it is, one there is joining hands with God's suffering. Okay, now, this has to be, you must keep both, for Bonhoeffer, both poles, arcane discipline and this identification with non-Christians, going at the same time. Because arcane discipline by itself would revive the worst characteristics of the sectarian heritage, and the Christian group would soon become a very exclusive in-group, and the very sharp demarcations would be made between Christians and non-Christians, and Christians would be those that had the truth, and non-Christians would somehow reside outside the pale. So he's worried that the church not, or he's concerned that the church not become the pious, self-righteous kind of ghetto in its intense life together. The way to prevent that is the full identification with non-Christians in the life in the world. But if you have only the identifications, Christian making common cause for the common good with non-Christians, without this other pole of arcane discipline, then you soon have a loss of Christian identity, which is the very source of the reasons for being involved, so that only doing justice among men would soon result in a kind of one-dimensional secularism, and the rich paths of spirituality of arcane discipline would be lost. But if you keep them both going, then the arcane discipline provides a sort of meaning and perspectives and energy for making common cause for the common good with non-Christians, and that identification with them and the sufferings of the world becomes the forms of mission and even much of the materials for discovering what Christianity really is. and a world come of age. Now, in connection with what we said yesterday, Bonhoeffer says that we don't really know who Christ is for us today, what Christ's present form, another word of Bonhoeffer's, is in the world. That must be discovered. And what I'm trying to say is that this is the sort of pattern by which Bonhoeffer says we will discover who Christ really is for us today. And he says we won't know who Christ is for us today without that full identification with non-Christians and the sufferings of the world. That, even that doesn't come just out of the arcane discipline. It is out of that engagement in the world. Okay. Our being Christian today will be limited to two things. Prayer, there's the arcane discipline, small group, low profile Christian order, and doing justice. There's the identification with the non-Christian. All Christian speaking, thinking, and organizing must be born anew out of these two things in constant conversation. All right, I think I'll leave it at that for this, and let's just chat.
I'm talking about the command from Micah. I can't quote exactly what God requires.
Yeah.
Walk under it with God
and do justice.
Do justice.
Love mercy.
Do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. Yeah.
I do wish you would give us something of his background.
Yeah.
For one thing that may be an unfair question, not to you, but to the dead great man, is 1952 and 33, what were your policies and how did you vote?
Yeah. That's
where the wickedness started.
Yes. What I thought I'd do, but I don't want to cut off any sort of conversations on this business. What I thought I would do is just start from the beginning and do this biography of his life and thought. Paul?
Before you get into that, I'm bothered by what is the principle of inclusion in this conventicle? Is it anybody who's willing to get up at 6 o'clock to do the order of matins gets in?
The answer to that is going to have to remain a frustrated one. Bonhoeffer just doesn't say much along those lines. You can pick up some examples from the underground seminary where there were such rules, but that can't be taken as a model for the church. It's just sort of part of this line in Bonhoeffer. And he doesn't ever set out sort of this picture of the church, much more than I've told you, and doesn't answer the question of inclusion or whether there are some creedal affirmations that are minimal in their binding nature. That simply isn't answered, and I can't say any more than that. It's sort of picture in the round, and it's an absolutely vital question, but it isn't. The answer isn't so far. He's searching.
Deal with the issue of how do you pump new blood into that kind of organization?
No, and there is, in fact, a total neglect of talking about it as organization, as such, and even the organizational elements, or how you build it, in fact, in terms of nuts and bolts. He does this all theologically and experientially, but he doesn't ever deal with it in terms of sort of nuts and bolts institutional way. Now, that was part of it, was to be part of his task, but his life came to an end, and the plot on Hitler's life failed.
I have one other question in terms of the twofold.
Yeah.
Does it logically follow that just because the Christian is, proponent Christian and doing his Christian thing in this corner, does it logically follow that if he steps into another corner to do his justice to others, that that prevents the other fold from becoming a ghetto? I don't know if that logically follows.
Well, good question.
I don't think it follows logically. I think they both come from the same center, and the two poles one and then two.
No, I don't think the logic has to be one and then two.
Well,
I'm not so sure. I mean, I just can't, you know, I just can't assume that one would happen because the other exists.
Well, almost by definition, if this group, Christian Assembly in secret, goes out into the world to do justice, they are not ghetto.
Yeah.
And I would say ghetto means you say anything that's outside of our little world doesn't count. No, ghetto, really, we misuse the term. But a ghetto is a place where people went to be apart, to be protected, to have their own. Jewish ghetto. Wasn't the ghetto originally something chosen by the Jews?
Well, it's a combination.
It was a place of protection.
Yes. There's a long history there, but for the most part, it's a combination of that chosenness or that preference, a combination of that and certain laws of the restriction. If you go to the ghetto in Prague, that was the center, and that's where Jewish life was chosen by Jews. But it wasn't very long where all Jews had to live as well, and so it became a bigger
sphere. The ghetto was kind of a theological self-righteousness.
Now here, at this point, I see what you're getting at. In terms of Bonhoeffer, at this point it's probably important to interject his theology, because his theology is one in which there isn't, what counts is not our own sufferings, but the sufferings of God and the life of the world. Where God, for Bonhoeffer, is most intensely present is in the life of the world. So that it can't be a theological self-righteousness in the ghetto for him, because that very theology thrusts him into the world. Jesus, he says, is the man for others. Now, that's not a sentimental phrase, which means, roughly translated, be nice to your neighbor. He means by that, Jesus is the man for others. Life is put together in such a way that only in being for the neighbor is human reality, does human reality, as it ought to be, come to expression. Only in that relationality. So that sort of outward-directed service or outward-directed mission is theologically critical to discovering God. Luther, this is straight out of Luther, Bonhoeffer gets this straight out of Luther, in which Luther says, Christ is to be found in the orders of creation. Where do you discover Christ? Not in looking into the interior of the self, but in the meeting with the neighbor. So Jesus as the man for others, pushes it that way. Your point's well taken, though. You could have a sort of schizophrenic church where worship means one thing, and a sort of intense community means one thing, and sort of life in the world may seem essential, but there isn't an intimate kind of a necessary and logical kind of relationship. I think in Bonhoeffer's case, his theology prevents that from happening. Well, should we just start sort of from the beginning and walk through his life and thoughts and pick up a few passages along the way and chat? It's important to say something about his family. Bonhoeffer was born in 1906. His father held the chair of psychiatry at the University of Berlin, and was kind of the leader of the other school, other than Sigmund Freud in Vienna. So Karl Bonhoeffer, Dietrich's father, was an eminent professor. And the family lived in Grunewald, a part of Berlin, where the upper bourgeois professionals lived, doctors, lawyers, government workers of high office, professors. And this was a very intense kind of class thing. These people associated with each other all the time. And this was a very intense kind of class thing. These people associated with each other all the time. The upper bourgeois, we would, I guess, say upper middle class, but it means something a little bit different. And the aristocracy, like the landed gentry, were later the source of the resistance, prime source of the resistance against Hitler. And part of that was that Hitler was such a barbarian, cultural. He was just an absolute, what's the word? I can think of something that probably shouldn't go on the tape.
It's not entirely fair. Of the 20 leading Nazis, at least 18 of them had an interest in art before they had an interest in politics. And to some extent, they went to politics because they were mediocre or they were failed artists.
Like Hitler.
Peter Berg's book on metapolitics was the first to point that out in 1920 with
his PhD at Harvard. But even these folks, we're not, what I'm saying is that they're not of the same group. Or put it later, this upper bourgeois and aristocracy split in its allegiance to Nazism. But this class, upper bourgeois class, became a chief source of that. And Bonhoeffer, from the very beginning, his politics were to the right. They belonged in the tradition of Prussian conservatism, a hierarchical nature of society, male over female, upper class, peasantry. That long tradition of Prussian conservatism was the one into which Bonhoeffer was born. So he comes, in his opposition against Nazism, comes from the right, politically. And in 1933, when Hitler came to power, Bonhoeffer went on the air and gave a speech warning the German people against the Führer, against Hitler. He didn't call Hitler by name, but he said it's really a warning against a cult of personality in Germany. And the reason, and the way he did that was that he said certain offices is put together by God in the nature of certain offices. People have different responsibilities, and you shouldn't ever, it's the terms of the office, it's the duty of these various offices, governmental offices, to do this and that, and you mustn't ever worship any person. It's the function of the office that counts, and not the person. So it's out of that kind of, and that's Prussian conservatism. So politically, it comes from the right. Well, this family, into which he was born then, was a family from the right politically, culturally very refined, and so Bonhoeffer learned music. The family would have its own sort of chamber music. Readings to one another. When Bonhoeffer later wrote poetry and novel fragments and things like that, it all comes out of this milieu. In fact, one time Bonhoeffer calls for an aristocratic Christianity. He wants something with taste. He was so far from being a not simply a member of the proletariat, but really from being a Democrat, small d, that it's not funny. He's a very different figure. When people think of Bonhoeffer, they think of I remember in the late 60s, people sort of picturing Bonhoeffer and Daniel Berrigan and Che Guevara, all sort of on the same line. Bonhoeffer was so far from being a sort of a revolutionary in those senses, it doesn't bear much resemblance. Now, that may raise some questions for you. We can get into those. All right. Just to give you some idea of the family then. His older brother was an atomic physicist who, when he found out that his research in atomic physics, which was the kind of research that led to the discovery of heavy water and led to the building of the atom bomb, which is what Hitler was working on. When he found out that his research was going in that direction, his older brother switched fields so as not to be involved in that. Another older brother, Klaus, became the chief counsel lawyer for Lufthansa Airlines. His brother-in-law held a very high post in the Department of Justice. This is sort of characteristics. It's a family that's part of the establishment. They're high up and on the inside. Okay. Now, the family participated in terms of its Christian faith only in a very general sense, in this kind of Christmas, Easter, sort of, and rarely went to church. Although the mother read them Bible stories, etc. But all of that sort of Christian education was simply a part of sort of the heritage, the culture. And it's speculated by Bonhoeffer's biographers that his interest in theology comes out of a psychological reason to do something well that nobody else in the family did. There were two groups in the family. There were the older kids and the younger kids. Bonhoeffer had a twin sister, and then there was a younger one than that. And there were the older boys and the older sisters. And the older kids had already excelled at so many things by the time Bonhoeffer, as the youngest boy in the family, came along and had such a drive to achieve and to do well that it's speculated that his choosing of theology, because nobody else was interested, there was a family of kind of scientific agnostics in his dad and in his older brothers. There's something to it. There's something to it. I think that it's to be found in the things that Bonhoeffer wrote as a child, in which he identifies along these lines. However, at the same time, theology for Bonhoeffer becomes primarily a matter of intellectual ideas. Bonhoeffer's own life in the church is not intense in terms of worship, other things, until the resistance, until the confessing church struggle. In other words, his education in theology and his interest in theology precedes his involvement in the church. And if you look at his writings, his dissertations, for example, Act and Being and Communion of Saints, they are miles apart in terms of their tone. Of course, they must be his PhD work. From the later kinds of things, cross discipleship, and so on. But there's a break there, and his biographer and his best friend, Eberhard Baeke, in the biography, when he moves from being professor of theology at the university to being pastor in the church, and that whole section is entitled "From Theologian to Christian." But that may be a little bit overdone. But what I'm saying is that it's out of this family and out of this background that theology is primarily then the level of involvement. All right, let's a year in Union Seminary in New York comes in there, 1931. 1932, Nazism becomes a major force. 1933, Hitler comes to power. The whole family from the very beginning is unequivocally opposed to Hitler, and that's important to know. 1933 through 1939 were the years of the so-called Kirchenkampf, the church struggle. The church in Germany, I'm talking about the Protestant church now, split three ways in confronting Hitler. One group was intensely opposed, and that became the confessing church. And within the confessing church, Bonhoeffer was always to the left, so to speak. That is to say, he always wanted to join Martin Niemöller and others in wanting to take the most radical actions in making the cut clean from anything that had anything to do with Hitler's policy. The Confessing Church then first was a movement within the established church, and then finally, 1936 it would have been, became a separate church with its own seminary, its own way of paying the clergy and so on, split off. There was another group called the Deutsche Christen, the German Christians, which tried to accommodate Nazism and Christianity, worked at that thing, supported Nazism and Hitler, tried to sort of convert Nazism wherever it looked pagan. And there was a third group, which were made up largely of Lutherans, called the Neutral, that said, church is church, state is state, faith is faith, politics is politics. Let us preach the gospel, And it works its way out as individuals in their own lives, but the church does not, as church, confront the state as state. We don't say what laws ought to be made or what laws ought to be rescinded. That's not our job.
One footnote here. When the Cold War was at its worst, and I don't think Burr was pretty much a Cold Warrior, although he was pretty intelligent about it, he and Karl Marx had, Karl Barth had a significant difference, but Karl Barth said that you should not label the communists as being Stalin, kind of an agent of the devil. And in a sense, Karl Barth recommended the sort of Stalin to the Christians in the Second Cold War. There's a crude parallel.
Now, since Karl Barth comes out of the Confessing Church, I would want to qualify, qualify that.
I would call it a bit.
Bonhoeffer said, and he wrote it many times, it was the neutrals who were the most dangerous of all. The Deutsche Christen, we know where they stand. But the neutrals were the, he says they are the most hostile to Christ of any of the groups. All right. Now, at this time, Bonhoeffer is writing a series of meditations which constitute the book, The Cost of Discipleship. And I just want to read a few passages from there, because it is during these years of 33 to 30, about 39, that Bonhoeffer sees a very narrow path for Christianity. It must be an uncompromising faith that is in resistance to the culture in which it finds itself. And that comes out in this book as a contrast between cheap grace and costly grace. And cheap grace amounts to this kind of coming to terms with the culture. And costly grace is this very narrow path for Christians. So these meditations are written out of the church struggle. We don't know that, but it may be helpful to you to know that, that's the background. Cheap grace, you can hear though, even the words today in here. Cheap grace is the deadly enemy of our church. We are fighting today for costly grace. Cheap grace means grace sold on the market like cheap jack's wares. The sacraments, the forgiveness of sins, and the consolations of religion are thrown away at cut prices. Grace is represented as the church's inexhaustible treasury from which she showers blessings with generous hands without asking questions or fixing limits. Grace without price, grace without cost. Cheap grace is the justification of sin without the justification of the sinner. The world goes the same old way, and we are still sinners even in the best life. As Luther says, well, let the Christian live like the rest of the world and then forgive him. That's cheap grace. Cheap grace is the preaching of forgiveness without requiring repentance. It's baptism without church discipline, communion without confession, absolution without personal confession. Cheap grace is grace without discipleship, grace without the cross, grace without Jesus Christ. Costly grace is the treasure hidden in the field for the sake of which a man will gladly go and sell all that he has. It is the pearl of great price to buy which the merchant will sell all his goods. It is the kingly rule of Christ for whose sake a man will pluck out the eye that causes him to stumble. It is the call of Jesus Christ to which the disciple leaves his net. And that's and follows him. Okay, then just one more line here. And again, referring to the situation at the time. We Lutherans have gathered like eagles round the carcass of cheap grace, and there we have drunk of the poison that has killed the life of following Christ. But do we also realize that this cheap grace has turned back upon us like a boomerang? Now this is straight out of what's happening in the churches. The price we are paying today in the shape of the collapse of the organized church is only the inevitable consequence of our policy of making grace available to all at too low a cost. We gave away the word and sacraments wholesale. We baptized, confirmed, and absolved the whole nation unasked and without condition. A humanitarian sentiment made us give that which was holy to the scornful and the unbelieving. We poured forth unending streams of grace. But the call to follow Jesus in the narrow way was hardly ever heard. Where were those truths which impelled the early church to institute the catechumen? There's arcane discipline. The early church said you can't be a member of the church until after a certain period of instruction, discipline, meditation. It's called the catechumen. And you couldn't attend. In the early church, in the New Testament church, you could participate in the service up to a point. And then if you were a member of the catechumen, you had to leave. And then the rest could participate, and that was the Eucharist.
This is still a test of the liturgy, where they say, close door,
Where were those truths which impelled the early church to institute the catechumen, which enabled a strict watch to be kept over the frontier between the church and the world, and afforded adequate protection for costly grace? What had happened to all those warnings of Luther's against preaching the gospel in such a manner as to make men rest secure in their ungodly living? Was there ever a more terrible or disastrous instance of the Christianizing of the world than this? What are those 3,000 Saxons put to death by Charlemagne compared with the millions of spiritual corpses in our country today? With this, it has been abundantly proved that the sins of the fathers are visited upon the children under the third and fourth generation. Cheap grace has turned out to be utterly merciless to our evangelical church. Cheap grace has turned out to be utterly merciless to our evangelical church. All right, that's just a taste of the kind of contrast that Bonhoeffer sees between the confessing church and or what the confessing church had to undertake in those times. Now, at this time, Bonhoeffer in the 30s is a pastor in the confessing church, but before that, in 31 and 32, and before he found the university to be intolerable, the university collapsed to the Nazis, among the earliest of the institutions, and it was only the church actually that didn't, and there the church split in one part. But before the Nazism became intolerable at the university, Bonhoeffer was a professor of theology, and he gave lectures which are printed today now as the book Christ the Center. I mention this because at the heart of Bonhoeffer's theology is his Christology. And at the heart of his Christology is the understanding of God as a suffering God. The theology of the cross, God not in his omnipotence, omnipresence, not that picture of God, but God as a suffering God. Now, I won't go through that in the Christology, but I'll read you a poem of Bonhoeffer's which gets at this in Letters and Papers from Prison. It's the same Christology. In fact, in Letters and Papers from Prison, he says, only suffering God can help. This is the poem Christians and Pagans. Men go to God when they are sore bestead, pray to him for succor, for his peace, for bread, for mercy for them, sick, sinning, or dead. All men do so, Christian and unbelieving. Men go to God when he is sore bestead. Now listen to the picture of God here. Men go to God when he is sore bestead. Find him poor and scorned, without shelter or bread. Whelmed under weight of the wicked, the weak, the dead. Christians stand by God in his hour of grieving. There is a difference between Christians and non-Christians. Christians stand by God in God's grieving. God, here's the last verse, goes to every man when sore bestead, feeds body and spirit with his bread. For Christians and pagans alike, he hangs dead, and both alike forgive him. God goes to all men in their suffering, weakness. For Christians alike, he hangs dead and forgives both alike. It's Christians who stand by God in his suffering. Well, the picture of God is the picture of Jesus as the suffering one for others. The picture of the suffering God. That comes out of Bonhoeffer's own experience. He sees in the sufferings of the Jews in Nazi Germany a picture of Jesus. And one place at which Bonhoeffer had some run-in with the Confessing Church was that Bonhoeffer insisted that the Confessing Church take a stand on the Jewish question. He kept insisting, Jesus is, not was, Jesus is a Jew. And Bonhoeffer locates God in the suffering of the Jews, not the German, among other places. It's out of this Christology of the Theologia Crucis, Christology of the Cross. God is a suffering God, only a suffering God can help. There's a scene out of Elie Wiesel's novel Jerusalem. Elie Wiesel is sometimes called a modern Job. He's a modern Jewish author who survived the concentration camps at Auschwitz and Dachau, lost his family there, and who wrestled with Judaism in a post-Auschwitz world. Elie Wiesel has a scene in the concentration camp where a young boy is being hanged, and the crowd, his fellow Jews, are watching. And as the boy suffocates to death from the rope around his neck, one of the members of the audience says, "Where is God now?" And the person behind him says, "There on the gallows." That's Bonhoeffer's picture of God as the suffering God, the one who is identified with others in their suffering. Not all suffering is godly, don't get me wrong. But Bonhoeffer says Christians are those who participate in the suffering of God in the life of the world. So I just mentioned that because this Christology is formed now in the 30s. At the same time, it's a Christology that encompasses all of reality. In theological terms, we would call it a cosmic Christology. Yeah, that one. I think he's clear about his picture of the suffering God, but he isn't clear about what that means. Or the question of omniscience, omnipresence. But it is clear that Bonhoeffer's Christology is also this cosmic Christology in which he sees all of reality as somehow in Christ. So that Bonhoeffer's understands the incarnation in these sort of cosmic terms. Bonhoeffer sees God's presence in all of being. And there are some marvelous passages in the book Ethics along these lines. Now that doesn't answer a lot of the tough theological questions. It does say that in terms of classic pictures, Bonhoeffer's Christology is the theology of the cross, the suffering of God. That Christology, however, that is expanded in such a way that it becomes part of the tradition of seeing all of reality as in Christ. So the distinction between church and world simply dissolves Christologically. I think our time's about to end. I want to say one more thing, and then tomorrow we'll pick up and talk about Bonhoeffer's involvement in the resistance. Just a couple more things about this time during the church struggle. There's a characteristic of Bonhoeffer that I find remarkable. He is always, despite the fact he is immersed in a heritage and tradition, and as this draws upon his past, he is always breaking with the German past. So, in the 30s, it was unheard of for a Christian pastor and theologian to become a pacifist. And Bonhoeffer is intensely attracted to Gandhi at this time, and the cost of discipleship has some very strong pacifist theme in it. It was unheard of for a clergyman to become a political conspirator. My, that was a heresy of the first order. To be involved in politics was the first transgression, but to be involved in sedition was simply out of the question. It was unheard of, really, for the academic theologian to pay any attention to the empirical sciences, and Bonhoeffer's dissertation on the church was included a lot of work in sociology, and it is a kind of sociology of the church, you have to understand, particular schools of German sociology. But he is, at every point, Bonhoeffer makes a very sharp break. This puts him in the confessing church often very much alone. In his pacifism, his group of students in Finkenwalde, in the underground seminary, they were opposed to Nazism, but when the draft came along, they just didn't, they said, you know, we don't fight for Nazism, but after all, if your nation calls you, you must go. So Bonhoeffer was at odds with a number of his students, and two-thirds of those seminary students were killed in the war. Yeah.
Well, that's that. Most American Quakers, like Richard Nixon, went to the service, don't
know. Yeah. All right. Then the attraction to Gandhi was an attraction of nonviolence, the ashram, and the picture of Gandhi as suffering love. He says, is Gandhi not the embodiment of the gospel in other deeds and words? Because there is a picture of Bonhoeffer's Christology in Gandhi as suffering love, being for others. Now, what's intriguing now, remember this picture of Bonhoeffer's pacifist in attraction to Gandhi in the middle of the resistance on the one hand, and then moving into the resistance and becoming a political conspirator, and even being a volunteer, if he should so be asked, to be the assassin of Hitler. How do those things all go together? Is there a radical break in Bonhoeffer's thought and life at that point, or what? There's one last thing, because it becomes important to where he goes from here. During the church struggle, he took up a parish in London for a couple of years among German emigres and expatriates. During this time, he becomes heavily involved in the ecumenical movement and becomes the youth secretary for in the ecumenical movement. But he keeps in touch and works in the confessing church, not only doing it from abroad. He makes the acquaintance of Bishop Bell, who understood the German church struggle. And he makes the acquaintance of people like Visitrift in the ecumenical movement. All this I just want to include because it becomes vital then to Bonhoeffer's engagement in the 40s and in the resistance movement. He has, during this time, constant contact with Berlin, with his family, and during this time his family is becoming involved in resistance against Hitler. But they're doing it from within the chief organization. So his brother-in-law at this time is becoming a high official in what was Abwehr, which is the Army Counterintelligence Service. So the resistance now, in which Bonhoeffer's family is involved earlier than he is, the resistance now becomes located in the center of the Nazi war machine. What that means is that Bonhoeffer is going to have to face the question of parading as a Nazi, one who in the cost of discipleship is so adamant in making public the witness of the difference between Christian and Nazi. Now he's going to have to undertake the whole question of learning to be a good Nazi. And that his family is involved in it. And all this is stirring in in his mind at this time. Okay, let's leave it at that.